You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
The Galileo Affair by Dan Schwartz.
Hey, if you have an image in your mind of the Galileo Affair, it's probably something like this. So we see here a 19th century painting by the artist Joseph Flory, and we see this is an image representing Galileo's trial, a moment in Galileo's trial. We see cardinals sitting around whispering, maybe debating what should be done with this troublemaker in front of them. We see a man in armor right behind Galileo, representing the force being used against Galileo. And then we see the man in the middle, Galileo himself, standing tall, his fist on his chest, confident, defiant. If we zoom in on him, we see a man of 70 years old. He's not bowing down. There's this story that he supposedly, moments after this, says about the theory he's defending, and yet, you know, it's still true. The earth does move. And what was Galileo's supposed crime? Well, you might think you could go to the source. And if you go to Italy, this is a column you'll see right outside where Galileo was held prisoner. And in Italian, the column says something like this. This palace, right next to this column, formerly belonging to the Medicis, was a prison to Galileo, who was guilty of having seen the earth move or revolve around the sun. Now, if you have heard of anything before about the Galileo Affair, how closely does all of that correspond to what you think happened? Okay, I'm getting some yeses, some nods. But do you know that's the story? And is it really the story? What if I told you that the scholarly consensus today is that that is all a myth? So, for example, here's an account from a Galileo scholar named Maurice Fonacchiaro, who's a really, I think, solid, good Galileo scholar. And I'm gonna read a quote. He's talking about this column. The historical and cultural importance of this lesser tourist attraction is that it expresses one of the most common myths widely held about the Galileo Affair, namely, that he was condemned by the Catholic Church for having discovered the truth. Now, since to condemn a person for such a reason could only be the result of ignorance and narrow-mindedness, this is also the myth which is used to justify the incompatibility between science and religion. And that's a word, if you go through the scholarly literature on Galileo today, you'll see a lot of that word, the word myth. So whereas in the 19th century, we had books like this coming out, A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology, that's by the co-founder of Cornell University, Andrew Dixon White. That was, and this book, if you go through it, has a big section on Galileo where that supposed myth is told and used as an example of the warfare between science and theology. Whereas that was a common take in the 19th century, if you turn to today, you have books like this, which I don't know if you can read it, but the title is Galileo Goes to Jail and Other Myths About Science and Religion, because it is a myth that Galileo went to jail. It's going to tell, and in a way, it is a myth that Galileo went to jail, if that's something anyone believes, depending on what you count as a jail. So here's just one more example of this word myth coming up, and this is by another reputable Galileo scholar, actually a scholar of the Roman Inquisition, Thomas Mayer. He says, Galileo's case has nearly always been portrayed as a cosmic struggle between science and religion. Galileo stands heroically on the side of modernity, daring to claim that the earth moved and the sun did not. The only serious variant reverses the black and white and white hats and the black and white hats and blames Galileo for daring to defy the established order. So there are some on the side of the church who just say church is the good guys and Galileo is the bad guy. As you might suspect, according to Thomas Mayer, Given this general interpretation's widespread acceptance, it is a myth. Now, what arguments do these scholars offer? And very briefly, I think there are three main arguments for thinking that the Galileo affair was more complex than the 19th century myth indicates. And that we should re-examine what actually happened and the actual importance of it. And first, they make an argument that if we look at the 1633 trial of Galileo before the Roman Inquisition, that thing that was represented in that image we started with, if we look at what actually happened, they say, well, there was actually a complex legal issue at stake in that trial. People often might, the myth is that Galileo was on trial for believing the Copernican theory that the Earth is moving around the sun. And they say, if you look at the actual trial, that's not what the trial was about. It was about a legal issue, and we'll get a little bit into what that issue was. Second, they say, far from it being the case that there was something about Catholic doctrine or religion in general that necessitated that Galileo would be persecuted in this way, it's actually the case that Galileo had a good chance of being acquitted in the trial or not going on trial at all, that as far as Catholic doctrine is concerned, he could have won this thing or he could have been regarded as a hero. There's nothing about religion or Catholic doctrine that necessitated he was treated this way. Galileo had arguments defending himself that sound good from a Catholic perspective, and maybe those arguments should have won the day. And three, they point out that if you think that Galileo was sent to jail, or if you think he was demonized, or if you think he was treated really badly, actually he was treated more leniently and more fairly than you might think. That in fact, although there's this story of people not looking through the telescope and ignoring plain evidence that Galileo is presenting to them, in fact, they say Galileo, if you look at how people high up in the church were treating him, although there were some people outside the church who maybe didn't look through the telescope, people in the church thought he was a great scientist and they praised him and they wanted to treat him leniently because they wanted him to succeed and do well. So those are just three of the main arguments for why some of what people might think is a myth and why the situation is actually more complex. But it's all wrong. there are things about the history here that are more complex than someone would have thought if they didn't study the thing. And I think a lot of the details of what happened are really interesting and worth getting into, and there's a lot to learn from them. But the essence of what happened, the essence of the story of the Galileo affair is, it's the story of a scientific genius being persecuted by religious dogmatists. That's the essence of what happened. Now, yeah, it's not true Galileo went to jail, depending on what you mean by jail, and a lot of other stuff you might believe is not true, and I want to get into, as much as we have time for, some of the interesting details of what happened, and I think, for example, there are things we'll learn about how censorship actually operates, because it's not just, someone comes out and bans a book. So getting into the details is worthwhile, but I think the scholarly consensus today just loses sight of what the essence of the Galileo affair is, and I want to stress that essence. But to understand what happened, we have to begin at the beginning, and the beginning is the Protestant Reformation. So 1517, Martin Luther kickstarts the Protestant Reformation with his 95 Theses. The essence of what Luther is arguing is that the individual should be able to have a relationship with God on their own. They shouldn't need to go through the church as an intermediary. They shouldn't have to go to the church to find out what the interpretation of the Bible should be. They should be able to read the Bible for themselves and interpret it for themselves. They should be able to have faith by themselves and get to heaven through their own faith, not through deeds, not through some kind of indulgences granted by the church. So it's stressing the role, the ability of the individual to have a relationship with God on their own. And that, you know, kickstarts a whole movement throughout Europe. And in the midst of this, 1543, we have this apparently unrelated event, Copernicus publishing his book on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres, reversing the old view that the Earth is the center of the universe and all the planets and stars and the sun go around the Earth, and saying instead that the Earth goes around the sun. And then we get, in the years 1545 to 1563, the church feeling it has to respond to the Protestant Reformation. It's just growing and growing and growing, and the church is losing its authority, and they have to do something. They have to clarify its position, reassert its authority, and we get a series of meetings in the Catholic Church. It's called the Council of Trent, but it's not just one meeting, it's a series. And for our purposes, the fourth session in the Council of Trent is going to be very important. And not too long after that fourth session, we see Galileo born in Pisa, Italy. But here's what's important from the fourth session of the Council of Trent. Really take note of this. This is what a lot of Galileo's trial and the whole thing is going to be about. So the fourth session of the Council of Trent, among other things, decrees to check unbridled spirits. And the unbridled spirits are Martin Luther, Protestants. It decrees, the church decrees, that no one relying on his own judgment shall, in matters of faith and morals, interpret the Holy Scriptures contrary to that sense which Holy Mother Church has held and holds, or even the unanimous teaching of the fathers. So if the church or the church fathers have a position about what the Bible means, if it's a part of the Bible that's related to faith and morals, that interpretation goes. No individual can just, you know, decide for themselves and use their own judgment what it means. So just clarifying that position. By the way, the fourth session of the Council of Trent also creates, for the first time, the Index of Prohibited Books. So before this, there was no list of banned books, but this, for the first time, they create a list of forbidden books. Now, Copernicus is not placed on that list initially. Copernicus, still free, you know, no one's saying this contradicts scripture at this point. It's still, you're still free to believe that, still free to publish that. But there are other things that, you know, contain heresies that are placed on that list. And then let's turn to Galileo, who's born into this world, a world where the Catholic Church is reasserting its authority against the Protestants. And after some work early in his career on the science of motion, he turns in 1610 to the use of the telescope. So he hears that a telescope was invented by some opticians abroad, and he gets to work, you know, trying to improve the telescope by himself. And I mean, he realizes there's one really important use of the telescope, which can make him a lot of money in the military, you know, looking at ships approaching from, you know, pushing the shore. But I think more interesting to him was the idea we could use the telescope to look at the heavens. And he looks at many different things with the telescope. He looks at the moon and hypothesizes that the moon actually has mountains and valleys. He looks at Venus and he sees that Venus is like the moon in that has a full range of phases. You'll see, like, you know, a little sliver sometimes. You'll see the, you know, Venus in full display sometimes. And that turns out to be an important argument for Copernicus. He sees sunspots on the sun. He sees more stars than we ever thought existed, and so on. He makes many telescopic discoveries in 1610 with the telescope and puts out a book called The Starry Messenger, announcing these discoveries. But it very quickly happens that people come to Galileo and ask him, this is all very interesting, but doesn't the Bible say that the Earth is the center of the universe? Doesn't the Bible say that the sun goes around the Earth? Now, people come to him initially in a friendly spirit and ask these questions. And so initially, in a friendly spirit, Galileo responds to those questions. And he writes a letter to a student of his named Castelli, explaining his position about scripture. The essence of what Galileo says in response to those questions is that reason and sense perception have to be primary. That when we're talking about matters of understanding the universe, understanding the physical universe, the tools we have that are reliable are our senses and our reason. Now, Galileo does think that scripture is 100% true, but that's not a very reliable resource for learning about the universe, because scripture often speaks in parables and metaphors. It often requires a figurative interpretation. It can be ambiguous, interpreted in multiple ways. So even though it's true, we don't really know what it means, whereas senses and reason, that's reliable. So senses and reason, that has to be primary. And that's the essence of what he's arguing in his letter to Castelli, where he's responding to friends who are asking him these things. And with all that going on, people begin to denounce Galileo publicly. So there are some preachers, people delivering sermons, for example, this guy Larini, who get up and deliver important sermons where they explicitly denounce Galileo. And this is just one notable quote from a sermon by Larini. "How is it," he says, "that the earth, this so low and so dirty element, vile, unworthy, of little value, could dare to compete in some things with the heaven, with the firmament, with the pavement of God's feet?" So you have to do some work to get yourself in the mindset of a 17th century religious thinker, where the earth is really regarded as the center of the universe because it's so low, right? Even having Dante, hell is, you know, even the center. So the closer you get to the center, the more base and evil things are. Whereas if you go farther out, you're going into the heavenly sphere towards God. And notably, the objection to Galileo isn't only that he's contradicting scripture, but it's this whole worldview of Galileo's is objectionable. Like, Galileo is going to be introducing a worldview that's kind of ennobling to humanity. It's making us more perfect and better, and we're placed on a level, on the same level with the heavens. So there's a much deeper religious objection to Galileo than just that he's contradicting scripture. And this is explicit. If you look at the Starry Messenger in Galileo, he says the exact opposite of Larini here. So in the Starry Messenger, Galileo says he will provide demonstrations, quote, "for the benefit of those who urge that the earth must be separated from the starry host, chiefly for the reason that it has neither motion nor light. For I will prove that the earth has motion and surpasses the moon in brightness and is not the place where the dull refuse of the universe has settled down. And I will support my demonstrations by 1,000 arguments taken from natural phenomena." So in the Starry Messenger, Galileo makes a point to show, there's a nice part where he says, like, if you imagine what the earth would look like from the moon or from the heavens, we would be a bright planet, which nobody thought of before. And so we're not different in kind from the heavens. We are part of the heavens. But that act of making humanity and the earth more noble is part of what people are objecting to. Actually, I might go back a bit. At this point, Larini gets his hands on the letter to Castelli, the work of Galileo's, which explains how we can reconcile scripture and Copernicus. And the letter was intended for widespread distribution. You often wrote letters at the time that are sort of addressed to one person, but you want them to be distributed widely. Unfortunately, Larini gets his hands on the letter to Castelli and thinks, like, this is really vicious, and he forwards the letter to the Inquisition. And any time someone makes a complaint to the Inquisition has to investigate. So there are they don't have to necessarily go to trial, but they do interview witnesses. There is a real investigation where if that investigation went differently, it could have been 1616, where Galileo was already put on trial. But at this point, they investigate Larina's complaint, and they're not so persuaded that Galileo is heretical at this point. But as they're thinking about what to do here, one of the leaders of the Catholic Church, Cardinal Bellarmine, is consulted. It's actually a guy named Foscarini, another person who believes the Copernican theory is true, who writes to Bellarmine for his advice. And Cardinal Bellarmine responds, and this comes to be the church's position. He says to Foscarini, your paternity and Mr. Galileo are proceeding prudently by limiting yourselves to speaking hypothetically, not absolutely, as I have always believed that Copernicus spoke. This sounds so threatening in tone to me. I think he's definitely aware that Galileo believes that Copernicus is true. But he's kind of implying with this threat, you know, you better believe what I'm saying you ought to believe here. And now what does speaking hypothetically and speaking absolutely mean here? Speaking hypothetically means treating Copernicus as a useful fiction. So it's not really true, but there's stuff you can do with it as a device for calculation. You can predict when you're gonna see Mars over there in the sky. You can predict the next eclipse. And you know, maybe Copernicus allows you to do those things more easily, but don't say it's true because it contradicts scripture. And so this is what Bellarmine's saying is going to be allowed, treating Copernicus as a useful fiction. And he goes on, Bellarmine, to say, consider now with your sense of prudence whether the church can tolerate giving scripture a meaning contrary to the Holy Fathers and all the Greek and Latin commentators. Nor can one answer that this is not a matter of faith, since if it's not a matter of faith as regards the topic, it is a matter of faith as regards the speaker. So he's referring back here to the Council of Trent's decree that I mentioned, which says that in matters of faith and morals, it's the church's interpretation of scripture that goes. And now Galileo has been arguing that this is not a matter of faith and morals, that this is a matter of the structure of the universe. What does that have to do with faith? It's a matter of science. But Bellarmine very cleverly responds that, well, look, there are lots of just like factual claims in scripture that don't seem to have to do with faith when you look at the topic. One of his big examples here is what I have in the picture. So scripture says, you know, Abraham has two sons, and that doesn't seem to have anything to do with faith, but surely if you just had like, if you had some figurative interpretation of scripture where it wasn't really a guy named Abraham with two sons, where if like Abraham was, I don't know, a star and it had like two moons and that was your interpretation, I mean, that would just be totally undermining of scripture. So Bellarmine says, you know, look, everything in scripture is a matter of faith and morals. If not, when it relates to the content, then it's because you would be kind of undermining the idea that scripture is actually written by some religiously inspired source. And so this is all while the Inquisition received Larini's complaint and they're investigating, and then they come to a final decision about what to do about the complaint in 1616. They decide to handle it through the congregation that the Council of Trent had created that bans books. And what they decide is that this congregation of the Index is going to ban Copernicus's book until it's corrected to more clearly say it's just a fiction. And they're going to ban any book like it. So anytime a book comes out and asserts Copernicus's theory as the truth, it will have to be banned until it's corrected. And that is how they handle this. They don't decide to make anything a heresy at this point. They just handle it through this book banning function. And Galileo is informed privately by Bellarmine about that decision. And so we see here one of the reports about what Galileo is told after Copernicus is banned. So His Holiness, the Pope, ordered the most illustrious Lord Cardinal Bellarmine to summon to his presence the said Galileo and warn him to abandon the said opinion. Okay, so Galileo's told, stop believing Copernicus. And if he refused to obey, the father commissary, in the presence of a notary and witnesses, should give him a precept that he completely abstain from teaching or defending this sort of doctrine and opinion, or dealing with it. If he should not agree, he will be imprisoned. Galileo apparently agrees and says, okay, I will stop believing Copernicus. Now, I just want to stress, this is, you know, it's not about what Galileo can go out and do or teach. The main order here is stop believing Copernicus. It's about what can go on inside Galileo's head. I mean, just imagine if we had this sort of thing going on today and, you know, someone was thinking of defending some controversial view and you had the people out there who had the authority to come to you and say, stop believing it. It's not even stop publishing about it, stop believing it. And that's what Galileo faced here. So what does Galileo do? Well, really the only thing it would be right to do, I think, which is he's quiet, he waits. He does not go out and defend Copernicus for a number of years. But he waits, and fortunately, in 1623, there is a new pope elected. And even more fortunately, that new pope, his name before he became pope was Francesco Barberini. His name after he became pope was Pope Urban VIII. And that new pope had been longtime friends with Galileo and was regarded as a friend of astronomy, a friend of science. Just two quick facts to illustrate that, to give you a sense of their friendship. 1620, this new pope had written a poem to Galileo. And he sent Galileo a poem. It was about astronomy and praise of astronomy. It mentioned Galileo by name and was dedicated to Galileo. And then Galileo returned the favor. In 1623, Galileo dedicates his own book, The Assayer, to the Pope. And Galileo's thinking, finally, I have my chance where maybe I could get back to work on Copernicus and defend him. Now, of course, he'd have to be careful because something defending Copernicus as the truth is no longer allowed. But perhaps through discussions with the Pope, Galileo could come to some agreement about what he could publish, maybe figure out what kind of qualifications he could add to his book so it can get out there. And that's what Galileo does. He meets with the Pope, he talks with the Pope, a series of meetings, and they discuss, you know, what do I have to include where in this book so that it will be allowed and not censored and not get me in trouble. One point worth highlighting here, just note this way censorship is operating in this culture is maybe different from what you might think. This is kind of one of the ways of fleshing out the history that I think we can learn from. It's not just that books are banned. It's not just like you publish something and it's taken off the shelves. Censorship is operating over a long course of time in more subtle ways than you might think. So there are three groups, three bodies that can engage in censorship in this period in Rome. There is the master of the sacred palace. This is a guy in the church who, you know, can give his stamp to something to get it published. There is the index of forbidden books that I mentioned, but that only really comes in after something's already published and then they want to take it off the shelves. If it's not already published, that group has nothing to do, no power. And then there's also the Inquisition itself, where you can have a trial, and the trial can have as an ultimate judgment, these books are to be taken off the shelf. But even before any of those three groups have anything to say, I mean, Galileo already has the need to go to the Pope and have discussions. And so even what's going to be published is not necessarily what Galileo would have chosen to write. It's not what Galileo would have chosen to write. It's the result of negotiations, of compromises. So just note, the censorship doesn't only happen by the groups that are empowered to censor. It happens because you're forced to have what you publish be the product of compromise and negotiation. But Galileo does that. He has to do that to get this published. And he agrees to do a lot of what the Pope tells him. Nevertheless, what he publishes, and this is the famous book, The Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, ends up being a really powerful argument for Copernicus. So persuasive that really nobody can be mistaken in thinking he's treating it as a useful fiction. Like, it's just too persuasive. So persuasive, the church couldn't look the other way. The best way, I think, for you to get a sense of how persuasive it is would be to read it, because I can't possibly cover why it's so persuasive. It's extremely thorough. It goes through all the arguments for why Copernicus is simpler, why, for many things, both Copernicus and the old theory of Ptolemies would lead to the same predictions, but why there are a few predictions that separate Copernicus out. There's this passage here that I quote. So Galileo's considering all the different objections that the defenders of Ptolemy would offer him. And he considers those objections in their best light. Sometimes he makes those objections even better than they are if you go to those original sources. And people object, well, if the earth is moving and you throw something up, well, the earth is gonna move underneath it and it'll land over here instead of landing straight down. And he responds to that. People object, well, if the earth is moving, then how can birds just fly in a straight direction? Wouldn't birds get left behind? And he responds by saying, well, go out in a ship, a moving ship at a constant speed, and set up something that will mimic the earth. You can set up, dripping water so that, that's like rain, and the rain's not letting enough behind on the boat, and you can set up fish, and the fish aren't getting enough behind on the boat. That's like the birds. That's just the briefest taste I can give you, but this book is really a masterpiece. It's very readable. You don't have to be a great scientist to follow it. But because he had to compromise and negotiate to get this thing published, there are a lot of things about it that try to mask the fact that Galileo actually believes this. For one thing, it's a dialogue. So, Galileo's never in there saying in his own voice the truth, but there is one character, Salviati, who pretty much believes what Galileo believes. And then in the preface, Galileo adds lie. He says, this is about 1616 in the preface to the dialogue, complaints were to be heard after 1616 that advisors who were totally unskilled at astronomical observations ought not to clip the wings of reflective intellects by means of rash prohibitions. This may have been a complaint Galileo himself had, but he says the opposite. Upon hearing such carping insolence, my zeal could not be contained. So zeal for the church, he's claiming. That he thinks people are unfairly attacking the church, he's claiming. Therefore, I propose in the present work to show to foreign nations that as much is to be understood of this matter in Italy, and particularly in Rome, as transalpine diligence can ever have imagined. So he's saying, what's this book for? We want to publish this to show to nations north of the Alps, that is, north of Italy, we want to show them that the reason we reject Copernicus is not because we're ignorant of science. No, in fact, we understand here in Italy that Copernicus is the best scientific theory. But we want to show you that the reason for rejecting Copernicus is because even though the science supports it, religion is against it. And that's the claimed motive for the whole book, as stated in the preface. Nobody bought this, unfortunately. The book is just too persuasive to believe this. And so got Galileo in trouble. People again complained. The report about Bellarmine specifically warning Galileo to stop believing Copernicus, that resurfaced, and that resulted in the need for a trial. And the Pope in particular was furious at Galileo, because the Pope wanted more done in the book to be clear that he was not defending Copernicus as the truth. But the revisionists we started this lecture with, the ones who think that the traditional story of the Galileo affair is a myth, they'll now say, well, Galileo was treated more leniently than you might think. I mean, he wasn't sent to jail, right? Well, let's see how they treated Galileo because he lied about what he believed. So he's summoned to Rome, 1632, September. He's given 1 month to come to Rome. Now, just, you know, try to fill this out in your mind because, you know, it's not like he can take a car to Rome. It's a time of plague. He's a 69-year-old man. He's had arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis his whole life, terrible joint pain, nearing blindness. There's plague. It's a long, difficult trip to Rome, but he's ordered to go. Galileo writes to a friend in the church, Francesco Barberini, asking him to try to make his case to the Pope. Please, like, don't make me go. Maybe I could write a letter or maybe I can add more to the dialogue in the preface to make it clear that it's just a useful fiction. Just to get a sense of Galileo's mindset, I think it's worth looking at what he says to Barberini, Francesco Barberini. He says, the summons to come to Rome induced regret in me to have exposed to the world part of my compositions. It made me want to suppress and condemn to the fire those that remain in my hand, completely satiating the overweening desire of my enemies, to whom my ideas are so annoying. This, eminent Lord, is that affliction which, continuing without interruption to run through my mind, having added continual wakefulness to the weight of 70 years and to my other bodily indispositions, makes me sure that beginning a trip tiring for its length and extraordinary obstacles and discomforts, I would not live halfway through. But to no avail, Pope Urban VIII is really angry and says, I mean, he accuses Galileo of lying, like, you're good, you're not in pain, come on, just go, you're stalling. And he says, if you don't stop with this act, we're going to drag you to Roman chains. And eventually Galileo gives up, and in February 1633, he does arrive in Rome. He is put in a palace, which, you know, this is where people point to him being treated well, so he's not in, you know, a prison cell. He is in a palace, although he's told they don't want him walking around the city because I suppose they're worried about who he's going to mention Copernicus to. And what's Galileo facing? Well, this is a heresy trial. And heresy does come in degrees of severity and different kinds. But basically the worst that could happen to Galileo, and what Galileo is probably fearing, is that he could be convicted of formal heresy. And what that means is knowingly, intentionally, and obstinately, that is even after you're corrected, rejecting a truth of faith. And really the only other possibility on the table is vehement suspicion of heresy. And it's just important to note, I think it might be hard for us today to appreciate why they're even regarding vehement suspicion of heresy as a crime. Well, it's because they're worried about, you know, if you act in a way that makes you look like a heretic, that is going to impact other people looking at you. Other people might behave like you, and that might threaten other people's souls. So you're really a killer, even if you're only vehemently suspected of heresy, because you're perhaps preventing other people from getting to heaven. But it is a heresy trial. One of the big controversies about the Galileo affair is this question of torture. People used to ask, you know, was Galileo tortured? Was he threatened with torture? And certainly he might have feared torture, and I think part of what makes this so terrible is he may have feared torture, probably did. And when we talk about torture, the main type used by the Inquisition at the time was what I have depicted here, called strappado. Your hands are tied here, and then you're hoisted up by your hands, and typically they might read a psalm to count out the time, and once they finish the psalm, you're allowed down. Now, Galileo, my view is, was not tortured, but during one of the depositions before the Inquisition, where they're interviewing him, what they have to do, and they have to do this as part of the trial, is they ask Galileo, do you believe Copernicus? Like, and they, you know, they get all the facts, and they have to say, they have to threaten him with torture. So they say, now, do you still maintain that even if we are going to go and torture you? And Galileo says, yes, that's the truth. I don't believe Copernicus. What he claims, this is one of the lies Galileo tells as part of all this, and I think it's obviously a lie, and it was probably obviously to the church a lie. He says, no, I don't believe Copernicus. I know the book was really persuasive about Copernicus, but I'm just the kind of guy who gets carried away with my own intellect. Like, I just thought it was really cool to be able to make all these arguments, and I just got carried away, but I don't actually believe it. And that's what he says under threat of torture. But he was not actually tortured. And the reason he was not actually tortured is mainly because he was 70 years old, and they did not typically torture people who are 70 years old because the aim was not to kill someone, and they might die at that age. So if he was younger, maybe he would have been tortured. Now, when people talk about, you know, church leniency and how they're treating him because they do regard him as a great scientist, they point out, okay, at the end of this, he is convicted of vehement suspicion of heresy. They can't prove that he believes Copernicus is true, but he certainly looks like it, so vehement suspicion. And he is sentenced for the rest of, well, until the Pope decides to end it, sentenced to house arrest. And that's a picture of Galileo's villa at Arcetri near Florence, where he spent some of his years after this. But it's calling it house arrest, I think, underestimates how grave a crime this was against Galileo. I mean, it's not just house arrest. He was forbidden from speaking to people for a while. And so, you know, they're very worried, is he gonna like have conversations with people and persuade them of Copernicus? And so at first he's not really allowed to go anywhere, have any conversations. He keeps writing to the Pope because part of the deal is anytime he wants something else granted, he needs to write to the Pope for permission. And he writes permission, you know, can I have this guy over my house? So, you know, or you know, can I have someone over my house to maybe transcribe notes, or can Hobbes come over? And at first he's really not getting any permission to do anything, although most likely he's having conversations about Copernicus whenever he can. And the other thing is, realize there's no objective law here. So part of the deal is if the church or the Pope eventually comes to believe that Galileo does believe Copernicus, or if they come to believe Galileo is out there talking to people about Copernicus, the Pope can decide that, well, you now really are a heretic, and they can bring Galileo back before the Inquisition, and at that point, he'll be killed. And he has to live, I think, the rest of his life in fear of that happening. So, and you know, he wants to keep writing, he wants to keep publishing, he wants to keep talking to other scientists and talking to others. And if there are whispers, and people are whispering, and people are still denouncing Galileo before the Inquisition and claiming, people are claiming to the Inquisition, Galileo's still out there talking about Copernicus. And if they believe those stories, then Galileo will be brought back and tried again, and that time was certainly killed. So this is, you know, although there are things that are inaccurate about that story I started with, I don't think it's right to call that 19th century story a myth, because it gets at the basic truth of the story. And the basic truth of the story is that it's a story of a scientific genius against the dogmatism of the church. Let me go a little quickly through these. So we started with those three arguments for complexity, and we started with the argument that this was about a legal issue. And the trial of 1633 itself was about a legal issue, but what was the issue? It was that Galileo was ordered in 1616 to stop believing Copernicus, and you can tell from the book he still believes it. So he was disobedient. That's the issue. We are told that Galileo could have won this thing, that Galileo had arguments defending himself that are consistent with Catholic doctrine, and that's true. Galileo has arguments that seem consistent with Catholic doctrine defending himself. But still, the arguments against Galileo, I mean, yeah, nothing necessitated that they would win. But, I mean, all sorts of things are real threats to human life. But that doesn't mean they're going to kill you every time. I mean, a drunk driver is not going to kill you every time, but it's still a major threat to human life. And that same is true here. So, you know, basically, yeah, Galileo might have won this, and so what? And then, you know, what's so evil about how Galileo treated wasn't just, he was sentenced to house arrest. It's not one event. If you look at this whole, 20, 30 year story, it's the story of Galileo being repeatedly denounced, repeatedly having to negotiate what he's allowed to publish, having to fear his whole life, that he will be reported again and again to the Inquisition, having to deal with censorship at every stage, being threatened with torture, even though, on some level, he might know I'm not actually going to be tortured. Being able to be brought back again before the Inquisition if they come to think he's really does believe Copernicus. It's a whole 20, 30 years of Galileo being persecuted, not just, 1 year of a trial. And so if we go back to the image with which we began, the image of Galileo standing tall, his fist on his chest, there are almost certainly things about this that are historically inaccurate. I mean, Galileo probably did not look, that healthy at this point. But the image, the 19th century story, it captures the right symbol here. Galileo rightly symbolizes the man of science and a man of integrity standing against the church. And the story of the Galileo affair is the story of a genius standing heroically, standing up for the truth in the face of demands for obedience and demands for faith. His arguments, as I think we know, ultimately won out. That is, they were so persuasive that even with the censorship and even with the persecution, he won. And I think that's what we should close with, that Galileo won the day, in a certain sense, because he was just that great a scientist and that persuasive. Thank you. Take some questions.
Hello. Going back to Copernicus, what do you think was the political role, the role that politics played in the prohibition of Copernicus' work? Now, Copernicus being the top canon law judge in Northern Europe, authorized military action against the Knights of the Cross, who were then defeated at Grunwald, so that the church essentially had no longer any military power beyond Italy. And knowing canon law, Copernicus did not authorize the distribution of his work until he was on his deathbed. So there was also the matter of the long-term result was that Northern Europe was no longer under the military control of the Knights of the Cross and the military monks of the church.
But is the question what role politics played in the banning of?
Yes, because the matter of celestial motions seems sort of too physical for the church to bother with. But they had a real beef with Copernicus because of his political actions?
There might be things I don't know, but Copernicus is not placed on the index of prohibited books until 1616 as the result of this investigation into Galileo and other people defending Copernicus. So it doesn't seem that the timing seems unusual for those issues to have played much of a role. It seems like, given the 1616 timing, the main issue was the renewed interest in whether it contradicts scripture.
Hi, Dan. So, question about where does it clearly state in the Bible or some scripture that this geocentric view, right? Does it state it somewhere?
Good. And yeah, I skipped over that for time, so it's worth getting into.
Okay. And also, yes. Also, the follow-up is, if it does that, and if the religionists are saying that we're not against science, are they saying that today we know that we're heliocentric, so the scripture is obviously wrong? Are they saying that, you know?
Good. So there are several places in the Bible that are interpreted to be confirming either that the earth is the center of the universe or the sun is in motion. And sometimes those are separated out as distinct things. The book of Joshua is one place that people were pointing to. The book of Joshua describes a battle between Joshua and the Philistines. And Joshua prays to God for God to stop the sun in the sky so that they would have more daylight to finish the battle and defeat the Philistines. And God grants that, apparently. God stops the sun in the sky, and then there's more daylight to finish the battle. And the reasoning is, well, if stopping the sun leads to more daylight, then it must be that the sun was in motion. Like you can't stop something that's like the center and motionless. You stop it because it's moving around the earth. So that's one. There are other places, but I won't get into them. Now, you can read those passages in other ways, and Galileo, part of his argument in the letter to Castelli and then the letter to the Grand Duchess Christina, part of his argument was those passages should be read either figuratively or they should be read as speaking in terms that the common man will understand. And the common man, just the clearest way to say what happened to them is to say he stopped the sun in the sky. And today the church would go with the way Galileo interpreted those passages, in essence, which is to say it's kind of just speaking in a way people understand. But how do you know beforehand, how do you know whether to interpret it that way or whether to interpret it literally after all, you have to go through the church for your interpretation on matters of faith and morals, and you're not allowed to wait for the science to come in. You're just going by what scripture says.
My question is, do you think these complexity claims are just a mistake in assessing the facts, or is there a more underlying failure of method? I think this complexity thing, and I hear it all over and over again,
yeah,
also seems almost like they think it can't be anything in particular, not only that it can't be a story of injustice towards a scientist by a religion, it also can't be a story of kindness to a scientist. It can be a story of anything. It can be anything in particular. And when I hear that it could have won this trial, it sounds to me like they're saying, it's just a random sequence of events, no logic to it. Every one of them is contingent. Every one of them could have happened otherwise. So it's not a story of X. It's just some sequence of events that might just happened just because. So what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think the main cause of the people arguing for complexity of their arguments is a method of being concrete bound. That is, they don't have the skill of really integrating things together in terms of fundamentals. It's not they're really getting the history wrong factually, because a lot of what leads them to these arguments is correcting the historical record. I mean, there are lots of the painting I had up there, things that are in there that a historian would know are inaccurate. The room is all wrong. The room has a painting up in the background. That painting was not there. That painting was somewhere else. And historians have all sorts of interesting factual observations to make like that, and they're true. but they, everything strikes them to some extent as like a disconnected concrete, and they can't identify the fundamentals.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How do you think the revisionists would respond to this presentation?
That's a good question. How would they respond to this presentation? It's a hard question to answer because it might depend on the particular revisionist. I kind of lumped a lot of people together under that heading.
Now, there are things
I had to go either skip or go quickly through because of time. So they, you know, I did not stress in this presentation Galileo's own thinking about scripture. And so they might just put pressure on some of the things I skipped over for time. But yeah, maybe let's talk privately because it's worth thinking more about that.
Yeah. One of the arguments that the revisionists make is that Galileo brought it upon himself. So partly it's that he acted sometimes sneakily, wrote multiple letters, etc.
Yeah.
And then the other is that there's other scientists in Italy at the time that aren't, you know, make discoveries that go against scripture but are not censured. So what do you think of that?
Yeah, that's true. Galileo acted sneakily. I mean, Galileo, I mentioned a number of cases where Galileo told lies. Like the preface is a total lie. And even under threat of torture, Galileo told a lie about what his real motives were. And there's a lot of clever rhetoric in Galileo's writings that maybe rub some people the wrong way. But the lies are a show of integrity. Like Galileo is doing whatever he can to get the truth out there. In that environment, he has to be sneaky and tricky and think about clever ways to get a good argument out there while still being allowed to do it. To blame Galileo for that is absurd. To blame Galileo for telling lies when the only way to get this published is to tell lies, that's not sneaky. That's part of what makes this a man of integrity.
But there are other scientists at the same time who make discoveries that go against scripture, like Gassendi or Serge Alpino, that do not get to.
Are they in Italy? I mean, Gassendi would be French, no?
Gassendi is French, but he's working originally in Italy, and then Cisalpino discovers the way.
Okay, yeah, I don't know if I know enough of the details of what happened. My suspicion would be, I mean, if they're in the, if they're close to Rome, I think they would have a hard time, unless it just didn't occur to someone that, you know, there's a passage in scripture which is contradicting what you're saying. But on this issue, people complained, and maybe they got lucky and people didn't think to complain about scripture contradicting what they were saying. I mean, that can happen.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Dan, what were Galileo's contributions to the modern scientific method, and did the church have anything to say when they read, say, him and Francis Bacon about the process of acquiring scientific knowledge and validating it? Did the church have anything to say about that?
So on the part of the question about whether the church has anything to say about proper scientific method, not as a whole, no. They would have things to say about the priority on matters of faith and morals of scripture. I think they did have a regard for, a regard for observation. So actually, especially the Jesuits, because there are different groups within the church, the Jesuits had a very high regard for observation, and they looked through the telescope and confirmed Galileo's observations. But I don't think they had like a scientific method or any careful thinking about that. And I'm not aware of any comments on Francis Bacon from people in the church. And then part of your question was about Galileo's kind of impact on thinking about the
right.
scientific method.
Contributions.
He's often credited for bringing mathematics more into play, but I think we're at time, so I can talk privately more about
okay.
that.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Remember to subscribe wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to ayinrand.org.